My name is Peter McDonald. I'm one of the English fellows at St Hugh's College in Oxford, and I specialise in literature and English from, I suppose, the late 19th century to the present day is what I teach. And I have a range of interests in issues to do with literature, the law, literature and nationalism, literature and questions about, you know, its value and public importance, I suppose. The kind of areas that I cover. And I'm talking today to Elika Boma.
And I, Elika Boma, am a fellow at Wolfson College. I hold a position in what the English faculty calls World Literature in English, here in the English faculty. And I am interested in issues and subjects contingent to those of Peter, literature and nationalism, the good of literature in situations of national struggle, and also transnational interconnection. So, Peter, shall we proceed?
Great.
I haven't actually said thanks for this book.
No, yeah.
It's an incredible read and an amazing story. And one thing that struck me, having just come back from South Africa and teaching a few classes there on literature and nationalism and transnationalism, it struck me that as well as writing a history of censorship in the apartheid context across those four decades of the 20th century, you've also written obliquely something of an account of South African, the formation of South African writing, of South African national writing in those years. What also struck me about this book, and which I'm very impressed by, is how you move from a highly empirical, very detailed, finely textured study of the workings of the censorship board and the interactions of that board with a whole series of writers and writings to some what we might call universal propositions concerning the nature of the literary, you know, what literature is and the good of literature. Can you talk a bit about how that was, how that struck you, how that operated for you?
Well, I suppose one of the key things is the anomaly of the initial discovery. I mean, we should perhaps mention that both you and I grew up in apartheid South Africa, so there's more behind this than simply academic discussion. But one of the things that struck me is that we all have an idea of what censors are. You know, we tend to think of them as censorious bureaucrats, people whose vocabulary is limited to yes or no, and who are out to close everything down in the interests of the state. And in the case of South Africa, a very coercive, repressive state that was highly motivated by ideological concerns. That's the idea that we all have. I mean, the standard anecdote that we always used to get told was about the censors banning Black Beauty, Anna Sewell's strange little horse memoir. Which is a classic sort of story about stupid censors. In fact, it's not true. They didn't actually ban it, but we won't go into that now. But the thing that, so just going into the apartheid censorship archives, the thing that struck me most was who these people were. And just the fact that there were leading literary intellectuals, literary academics, writers, esteemed university professors. These are the people who are making these decisions. And not only were it these people, but there was a specific group of people who were especially powerful and linked to a particular marginal faction within Afrikaner culture. So that was the first big surprise. But the other big surprise was, which was also, I suppose, in some ways a very happy thing for me from an academic and intellectual point of view, was I suddenly discovered in these archives an absolute mass of evidence for one of the more abstract theoretical concerns that I've always had, which is to do with what is the nature of literature? What is literature? What's its function? What's its value in the public domain? And I had certainly been schooled in a theoretical tradition, a series of traditions, I should say, which is sort of post-1970 in the English-speaking world, where the whole question of what is literature is a vexed one, and that in fact we should stop asking that question, what is literature, trying to find some set of properties or some sort of qualities of the writing that make it literature. And instead what we have to do is to shift the whole debate onto who decides. So if you're thinking about it from that point of view, then the abstract theoretical question becomes in many ways a very concrete, very particularized socio-political question. And so for me, the linkages, if you like, between my theoretical concerns on the one hand and my historical discoveries on the other, were very, very close and very strong. And that it's one of the reasons why I wrote the book, yeah.
Was there a particular moment, thinking still of the story of the book, the backstory of the book, your story, was there a particular moment in the archives, a particular, you know, a document you pulled out, or a personality, a census personality you came into contact with? Was there a moment when things crystallized in that way, when you saw, you know, my God, these theoretical concerns that I've had these many years, they are pinpointed right here in this particular census report, for example?
I suppose, yeah, it was very early on, in the sense that where I suddenly developed, I initially went into the archive actually out of curiosity, and actually partly to win some arguments that I used to have in the 1980s with various peers in not particularly salubrious environments. One of the arguments was to do with the value of J.M. Coetzee's writing in the context of the struggle against apartheid. And the view I encountered was, one was either it's irrelevant or too high-minded, or it's actually inimical to the struggle. And one of the knockdown arguments used was, but look, he's never been banned. He was never banned. In fact, people knew that he'd also been let through by the censors. So he's clearly, this is not revolutionary writing. So that was an issue. That's one of the reasons why one of the first censorship reports I just tried to find in order to settle those, or to try to deal with those arguments, was to look at the ones for Coetzee. And one of the first ones I found were the censors reports on In the Heart of the Country, J.M. Coetzee's second fiction. And it was really reading, there were three censors reports, one by a poet and literary academic called Merva Skultz, the other one by an academic at the University of Stellenbosch called Charles Fensham, and the third one was by a very well-known Afrikaans writer, Anna Lowe. And so it was, first of all, that these were the people, first of all, commenting on it. Some of them were colleagues of Coetzee's at the University of Cape Town, Merva Skultz in particular. That was strange. And then the other thing was really, and I suppose it was Anna Lowe's report more than anything else. She tended to be quite effusive, and she wrote a lot. And just realizing that what these people were doing was hardly ever referring to the law. They just did not refer to the law. I expected to see reports where somebody would sit down and say, look, this is, you know, a piece of seditious writing according to clause 47.2a, and so on. Never, hardly ever referring to the law. Yeah. What they were doing were writing extended bits of literary criticism, often of an incredibly personal kind, which was also very strange. Mm. Far more intimate and personal than much literary criticism would be. They were giving you, in a sense, quite a raw response. Remember, it's a book that's just been published, mm-hmm. a raw response to this, which is often deeply felt and quite passionate. And so that was interesting. You know, what was this got to do with censorship? You know, the people writing these sorts of things. Of course, it was kind of funny to find out later on that Anna Lowe, in fact, reprocessed her census report as two newspaper reviews of In the Heart of the Country. So that was a further kind of anomaly. But it was just having to deal with this evidence. What am I to make of this? And then realizing, interestingly, that Coetzee was being let through by the censors because they believed his writing conformed to their idea of the literary, which they saw themselves as protecting. And of course, what's interesting is that Coetzee's writing was in many ways extremely hostile to that conception of the literary. So he's being passed as literary in terms that I think Coetzee himself, but certainly his writings, would repudiate. So having to deal with that and having to explain to myself why did these people even get there? Why were they there in the first place? That was a surprise. So that then forced me into a much bigger investigation into the history of the system and trying to explain that.
So what emerges from that too is a very profound sense on your part and a deepening sense across the process of producing the book of the complicity of literature with a capital L, you know, that civilizing force, the complicity of that with the state, the contamination of literature by the political, by the national, by the involvement of the police in the maintenance of literature with a capital L. Were you shocked by that, or did it, as I think you're implying, confirm certain suspicions that you'd had for a long time?
I was surprised by the extent of the power, if you like, of these people. I mean, in a sense, I suppose one of the things that you could say that the book deals with implicitly is it asks the question, in a sense, the kind of question you would think you'd never really ask, but what would happen if you gave literary critics real power? Not just people commenting in newspapers, not just people in academic discussions, but you gave them real power in the world. What would happen? Well, I think what the apartheid censorship system shows is that you would get extraordinary discrepancies and absurdities creeping into the public domain of literature as to what gets let in to that public domain as literature and what doesn't. You know, where again, you know, we would find that, say, a collection of poems by Mafika Gwala, quite clearly against the regime, quite clearly articulated within a black consciousness formation of the 1970s, asserting the dignity of black people via the lyric poem, all those kinds of powers, that gets passed because the censors admire the writer's oratorical powers. Whereas, in a sense, an equally interesting collection of poems by Ingopele Madingwane called Africa My Beginning gets banned because that's deemed to be seditious propaganda. So those, you know, that, what would happen if you gave critics real power? Well, their ideas of literature would have an extraordinary sway in the world and create a deformed culture in that way. So yes, I was always surprised as to how deeply implicated literature was. And of course, another thing I think probably worth saying is that the conception of literature that the apartheid censors had was not entirely peculiar to them. It was shared by many, you know, across what we could call the Western and indeed some parts of the Eastern world at that time. I mean, there are important local inflections and local differences, but nonetheless, many of their assumptions were widely shared. So that's where it becomes part of a much larger story. And I think, I hope it in a way it produces evidence where any of us professionally committed to the study of literature have to think about what we do and what we represent and what we are.
And what its implications are and its impact on the real world.
Sure.
If any.
Sure.
I mean, still thinking about this question of the, you know, the power that these censors had on the real world, which we as literary critics don't have in our context here, for example, sitting in Oxford today. And thinking also of the anomalies, as you've just said, that threw up, where, you know, one work of lyricism, a collection of lyrical poems, is passed and another isn't. What do you think, on the basis of the research, drove these largely Afrikaans literary critics stroke censors? What was the passion, was it for the nation as romantically conceived, or as you know, the people, the soul of the people? Was it that they were trying to safeguard, foster, protect? Or was it something else? Was it some sense of the experimental? You know, literature is pushing the boundary, and their sense that nonetheless, even though they were concerned to foster the soul of the people, they wanted also to allow the people room to express themselves,
mm-hmm.
yeah, in the modern world.
Yeah, I think of course that is where I had to go in terms of the longer history as to why these people were there. And I suppose the most interesting aspect of that is really the linkage between literature and nationalism, which is what you're touching on. Where what I expected, again, a standard view of, say, what Afrikaner nationalism represents, is it is an extension of romantic 19th century thinking, you know, that the kind of thinking associated with people like Herder and so on in the German tradition. It's particularly German Teutonic traditions of national thinking. But, you know, in many ways there's big questions in relation to Irish nationalism, you know, the kind of aspirations that underlay the anti-colonial movement in Ireland. Bearing in mind, I know from your work that you know that there were interesting connections between the Irish and the Boers in the 19th century, where the Irish were the only people, I think, in the Boer War shooting each other, where they were on the one hand on the side of the empire, and on the other hand, some were supporting the Boers.
Yes.
So, there's those historical linkages. But what was interesting is that there was, within Afrikaner nationalist thinking, and here we're talking about, when you say, you know, the soul of the people, we're talking really about a racialized conception of the folk. So the idea of the Afrikaner community only understood as a folk, and of course understand in racialized terms a white Afrikaans-speaking folk. So kind of a racialized ethno-linguistic people. If you trace it back to the 19th century, there's the mainstream view is the one that says, well, there's a thing called the folk spirit, the spirit of the soul of the people. And that what literature constitutes is the ultimate expression and embodiment, giving voice to that folk. So if you like, it's the way of getting at the essence of what the folk is. This was a mainstream Afrikaner view. And it has implicitly built into it an idea of what the writer is. The writer is the conduit.
Absolutely.
The spokesperson for the spirit. It's through the writer that the spirit of the folk emerges. So I certainly, that was what I thought was the view. But then as you dug into the history of the system, you realize that actually the most influential people ultimately behind why this particular group of censors had so much power in the system were a marginal group within Afrikaner nationalist culture of that time, still absolutely bound into Afrikaner nationalist culture. And they're associated primarily with a poet, a leading Afrikaans poet called N.P. van Wyk Loo. And one of the easiest ways, I think, of grasping N.P. van Wyk Loo's stature within Afrikaans culture is he's the Afrikaans equivalent of W.B. Yeats. He's as controversial a nationalist and as complicated a nationalist and as big a figure as W.B. Yeats. And the interesting thing is that even compared to Yeats, who still bought into notions, certainly in the 1890s, of the Celtic spirit, of the notion of some sort of essence or soul of the Irish, van Wyk Loo was in many ways, especially after the war, after the Second World War, in many ways a kind of modernist nationalist, who thought there was no such defined final thing as the folk's character. That actually the key thing about this character was that it was always open to the future, mobile, experimental, exploratory. And so the real reason why this particular group got there was not so much that there was a particular group of censors who wanted to protect literature in general. There's an element of that. But there's a particular group of censors who wanted to protect this idea of the folk. And what they had to do was ensure that clerics, as in Dutch Reformed Church ministers, and the political elite didn't get hold of the system. But actually this particular literary elite got hold of the system. And again, I have to stress that it was a marginal elite, a kind of an internal dissident group.
A fraction.
A fraction of that group. So the reason why these people were there is to protect the interests of that group who were interested in defending some notion of the folk as an endlessly open category, not as a closed, fixed essence, which had a spirit that the writer could manifest. So that was a real surprise. Dealing with the ramifications of that. So the ways in which it works out in detail in the decisions are, for instance, it's why these censors are both, on the one hand, interested in a writer as the voice of his or her people, whatever that might be, but also the ways in which the writing would achieve some sort of universality, because it would speak to this larger openness that they wanted to preserve, which they felt the clerics, with their anxieties about moral censorship and pornography and the hostility to writers as an elite, and certainly the politicians wanted to close down. So that was, I had to learn and rethink my assumptions about the relationship between literature and nationalism in order to try to understand that.
As modernism, the modernism of someone like N.P. van Wijkelo came in as a third factor, into that relationship of literature and nationalism.
Right. So it's a kind of a late 20th century version of nationalism, as opposed to simply what I thought an inheritance of 19th century nationalism.
That is so interesting. I mean, how was it from your point of view, as, after all, somebody has written about Conrad, as a modernist yourself in terms of your literary interests, to witness, to confront, to come up close to, again, this word resurfaces, the complicity also of modernist writing. You know, it's another aspect that connects us. I too have worked on early 20th century European modernism, and I have always personally seen the experimental, the avant-garde, almost as a good in itself, to push the boundaries of what we understand by the literary. But here, what your research uncovered was that modernism too was complicit with a particularly reactionary, race-entrenched form of nationalism.
I suppose the specifics and of course the power that these particular censors had, you know, again, struck me as anomalous, and simply the fact that anyway these kinds of this kind of thinking had anything to do with censorship decision making, that was a surprise. But in terms of the longer history of modernism, I would say no, it doesn't. It didn't completely surprise me, because I've always had the view that modernism isn't one thing for one thing. It's there are many modernisms. We're talking about a specific literary movement of the early 20th century, but also even within a rather closely defined kind of modernism, there are all sorts of anomalies. And you know, you can have certain kinds of modernist writing that head in the direction of some of T.S. Eliot's more rebarbative, anti-Semitic kinds of writing. And it's, you know, and it's of course, you know, I'm not saying it's simply and easily dismissible and identifiable as anti-Semitic, but it's a kind of writing that is caught up in rather standard cliched tropes about anti-Semitism. We're talking here about some of the quatrain poems. We talk about, you know, bits of the wasteland, things that were excluded from the wasteland. But also, in a sense, Eliot's whole relationship to a Western tradition of thinking, which I regard Eliot as, in a sense, very clearly reinforcing many assumptions built into the Western tradition, many of those assumptions which also permeated racist thinking. So there's that. But then on the other hand, you can point to, on say issues of anti-Semitism, of that specific one, or issues of race, you can point to someone like Joyce and you point to Ulysses. And that seems to be, you know, something completely different, and very, very consciously turning its back on that Western tradition of hierarchical thinking, of, you know, the superiority of certain bodies above other bodies, of even spirit above body. So there's a very mixed story about modernism, and of course we don't have to point to think people like Eliot. You can also look at, you know, Céline in the French context or so on, where the relationship between experimental writing and extremely reactionary forms of thought is never as easy and as comfortable as we think. So I never had that view, but I certainly, that didn't mean that there were not lots of surprises within the apartheid censorship decision process.
Again, it's that, to me, so interesting and so readable in the book, that trajectory that takes us from the, you know, the very specific, the decision made on a single day by a particular censor, or, you know, a particular, you know, avant-garde national poet, as in N.P.F. van Wyk Loo, to, you know, the wider ramifications of that in the world. If you like, the movement from the local or the regional, where that is South Africa, apartheid South Africa, you know, out to literature transnationally. And still keeping that trajectory in mind, coming down, as it were, to the specific again, I was particularly fascinated by the role that certain writers played in this story. So I wonder if we could pull out the name André Brink.
Right.
Up to this point, for me personally, a writer I've read in both English and Afrikaans, have never been quite sure about in terms of his literary interest. A very popular writer, globally popular. In this story here, the Literature Police story, Brink emerges as a much more interesting character than I had suspected. Could you talk a bit about the role of Brink in the story of the censorship board? I mean, the ways in which there were moments when he was passed, when, you know, his writing was actually, you know, quite controversial, but was he passed because he was deemed to speak for the soul of the people, or was deemed to form part of what you call the folk avant-garde, you know, the people's avant-garde, pushing the boundaries of what it was possible to say about the people? Or, you know, were there times then when he was held back because he was deemed to be pornographic and, you know, to fall foul of the more, if you like, conservative elements within the censorship board? Let's talk a bit about André Brink, who is, I think, a writer that people can relate
absolutely
to.
Right. I mean, he's a major figure, you know, a figure of huge, abundant energy, prodigious in his output, extraordinary. Also, the other thing I think people need to know most immediately about Brink in this story is that Brink is the first Afrikaans writer to be banned. Looking on Darkness, Kenneth van die Arendt is the Afrikaans title, 1974, it was the first Afrikaans book to be banned. I'd always known that. I think everybody had always known that in South Africa at one point or another. What I didn't know, and of course I think what most people had probably forgotten, was that until that point, a number of Brink's novels had actually got into the system. Interestingly, like a lot of Afrikaans works in the 1960s, got into the system via outraged church groups, who individuals acting under their influence, or actual groups of church groups, sent in his works and demanded that they be banned, largely on moral grounds. And the interesting thing is that a number of Brink's early novels of the 60s get let through. The censors decide not to ban them. The one in which they vacillated the most was a novel called, in 1967, I think I remember rightly, where it was published, called Miskin Nooit, or Maybe the English, Maybe Never. And one of the interesting things about that decision was that it was the censors were very, very divided. Basically, one particular faction thought this wasn't great enough literature to merit being passed. Another thought the opposite, and there was a big argy-bargy and discussion within the censorship board. What is interesting about that, though, is that this is Brink at that point being published by the leading publisher of the 60s experimental group called the Sestigers in Afrikaans, who were kind of, at that point, understood as a kind of an emergent folk avant-garde. They were in that modernist tradition, but taking it, if you like, crudely into a postmodernist direction. So a whole series of Brinks works, and indeed some Breitenbach works, were let through in the 1960s. And again, you know, just largely because this literary group finally, despite their internal divisions, decided that this was great enough literature and was important for the, you know, they said, you know, the intellectual and spiritual life of the folk. And the slight anomaly for Brink, I would imagine, and he wrote a really interesting review about this book, is that the people who were deciding his fate, at least two of them, had taught him as a student at the University of Potchefstroom. So his works are being decided by his former professors. The interesting change that then happens is in 1974, Brink, there's a crucial year within this younger generation of writers of 1968, which seems that 1968 was a crucial year for just about everybody, where they decided that, if you like, the notion of contributing and making a great folk literature was itself collaborationist. That actually that was caught up with a certain notion of a narrow conception of nationalism. However dissident you were, however critical you were nonetheless caught up in still an understanding of the Afrikaner community as a folk that had to have supremacy over everyone else in South Africa. And they broke with it. The person who led that was Breitenbach. Breitenbach. But Brink was also at the foreground of that charge, that internal debate with themselves, where they, in a sense, then started to move into a conception of the Afrikaans community, which was not only not racialized, but it was, in a sense, anti-folk. Mm-hmm. They broke with that mm-hmm. official form of dissidence, which the censors were allowing. Mm-hmm. And they broke, and they started to go into a more extreme form of dissidence, which they saw as fundamental. So the ways in which Kenneth van der Yard, it does not only that it's pornographic, that they regard the sexual descriptions as, and you know, there's kind of slightly silly things amongst the censors saying that, you know, that Brink's sexual descriptions are over romanticized, and there are other sexual descriptions that you can let through in Breitenbach's writing, whatever, that are less sentimentalized or whatever. Mm. There are those kinds of things. But the key thing is they start to say this is committed literature, and which they regard as a kind of derogatory category. To call something committed, to use a kind of Sartrean phraseology, this is literature engagé, and is therefore not literary enough because it's, in a sense, too political to be literary. Mm-hmm. And it's really that kind of thinking that starts to dominate the way in which the censors react to this new shift within the younger generation of Afrikaans writers, and they start to ban committed Afrikaans mm-hmm. literature, beginning with the Brink.
Mm-hmm. Well, that is such an interesting and key example of is of how the formation of what we might call South African writing in various languages across the 20th century comes out of, if you like, an elaborate dance of censor and writer. Mm. The censor decrees, if you like, or draws a boundary, the writer exceeds, but then is circumscribed again by the shifting definitions of the censor. So there's, you know, there's a push and there's a pull. A few days ago, I was engaged in a discussion with the translator, eminent critic, Leon de Kock, in Johannesburg, in which he was suggesting that what we might call South African literature no longer exists. Mm. You know, it's been so buffeted and infiltrated by global forces, genres from elsewhere, chick lit, if you like, the detective novel. And what I was suggesting in contradistinction to that is that, on the contrary, we continue to have a very, very clear sense of what South African literature is, and that it partly comes out of that elaborate dance between, if you like, the committed, the engagé, that which is concerned with the matter of South Africa, mm-hmm. And then exceeding it, going beyond it. From your research and from this book and the discussions that you've been having around it and subsequent to it, do you still have a strong sense that there is something we might call, perhaps especially now in the 21st century, South African writing, regardless of language, and if you like, a body of national literature that we can teach in the classroom, or do you think we've moved beyond that? Because if I can just add a final footnote to that, it seems to me that here you have, as well as offering a literary history of censorship in a particular context, you've also offered a deeply textually embedded account of the evolution of South African writing in the 20th century. De Kock was saying, look around you, where are the literary histories, the interesting 21st century literary histories of South African writing? I said, the literature police.
Good for you. I think we probably also need to start thinking about wrapping things up. But I think that's a really, really great and interesting question. I think probably my answer is twofold. That in a sense, on the one hand, now in South Africa, as in India after independence in 1947, there is a massively important nation-building project via literature, and indeed not only literature, orature, all forms of cultural expression of various kinds. There's a major effort because the forms and varieties of South African literature that we've had in the past have all been deformed. So there's a whole way of rethinking about this corpus or body of work which we want to call South African literature. So, the state, for instance, the Ministry of the Department of Arts and Culture has recently, in fact, in this month, is launching a collection of books called South African Classics, which are out of print books in African languages, isiXhosa, isiZulu, Setswana, and so on, by major writers of the 20th century. And going back to S.E.K. Makaya, A.C. Jordan, these kinds of writers. Cheap paperbacks being put into all public libraries. That's an enormously important exercise in, if you like, scholarship and publishing of reclamation, of reclaiming these traditions that were, through colonialism, apartheid, and so on, marginalized, or not sometimes valorized, but valued in problematic ways, to reclaim this tradition, to build up a fuller conception of what a South African literature might be like. And in many ways, going back to our discussion with Brink, that was Brink's challenge to his fellow Afrikaans writers. Don't you thinking too narrowly in terms of the folk. I want to identify with all the people who I share South Africa with, that this is a South African literature. So, that was a challenge back in the 60s for Brink. But now there's that challenge. However, at the same time, we've got this kind of nation-building project through culture, if you like, going on. Essential, indispensable thing to do. On the other hand, there's a challenge to it because of the conception of space that we now live in. The public space, the public domain. What is the public domain? Of course, where the movement of literary forms, of kinds of writing, of writings and writers themselves is now so much more profound. And of course, it's always been there. I mean, since the days of empire, it's always been about movement and transaction and borrowing and these sort of things. I think now with, partly also the ways in which the internet has disturbed our conceptions of space even, what does it mean to be in space? Well, what do you have access to when you're in space here as opposed to in space there? This has all changed quite radically. So at the same time, hence my answer is twofold. On the one hand, there's an essential nation-building project. On the other hand, there are all sorts of ways in which we have to think critically about the ways in which certain kinds of writing, literature, and so on can actually be made to fit that. And the ways in which the realities of the world now can be made to fit that conception. So I would again say, it's just a question of, partly a question now of who's deciding what's that. And let's think about who's deciding it. And then see what the result is, and then what questions it might still raise.
Thank you. Yeah, and I suppose by contrast, what is so unique and fascinating about the period that you track in the literature police is that the apartheid and the censorship board and the state at the time created, as it were, a bell jar effect within which a certain kind of national literature was being made to grow. We would now say stunted, perhaps, form, but a certain kind of national literature was being made to grow outside of and away from, hived off from the outside world. Whereas now, of course, and happily, that has come crashing in.